DW, Living Planet, with Sarah Steffen.
Welcome to Living Planet with me, Sarah Steffen. The world is heating up. Dangerous heat waves and raging wildfires across Europe and Alaska have destroyed huge areas of land. Droughts in other parts of the world, such as Nicaragua, have pushed people to the brink of their existence and led to climate migration.
There were great rains. In Sinandega, we had a great river. Today, there's no river. It's more like a puddle. Here, some people starved to death. Others got skinny. Those years were very hard around here. A lot of people left. The majority of those who left are now in Costa Rica, Panama, and Spain.
As temperatures are soaring, so is the demand for air conditioning, which creates its own vicious cycle. We hear how wastewater can help in cooling down buildings.
We're just using wastewater instead of the atmosphere. In the summer, when we most need cooling, it's very difficult to push heat into the very hot atmosphere like we have right now. It's very easy to push heat into the relatively cool wastewater. And because you're not fighting nature so much, it means the whole system has an easier job, it operates more efficiently, and it uses less energy to do the job.
And how goats can help prevent forest fires. All that and more coming up now. A heat wave struck large parts of Europe during the last week of June, breaking several records at single locations in France, Switzerland, Austria, Germany, the Czech Republic, and Spain. That's according to the World Weather Attribution, a group of scientists analyzing the influence of climate change on extreme weather events such as heat waves. The heat wave has now moved towards Eastern Europe, where temperatures soar to 39 degrees Celsius or about 102 degrees Fahrenheit in Serbia. The extreme heat also played a role as raging wildfires in Spain and Germany devoured huge areas of land. The fire in Spain's northeastern Catalonia region likely started when a pile of manure at a chicken farm self-combusted in the extreme heat. Germany's northern state Mecklenburg-Western Pomerania battled its worst forest fire in history, with some 3,000 firefighters, soldiers, police, forestry, and other service personnel trying to subdue the flames. The fire had spread to a total of 1,200 hectares. To put that into perspective, a soccer pitch is just under 1 hectare. It can vary from 0.6 to 0.8 hectare. Firefighting operations were extremely difficult due to the presence of unexploded munitions dating back to World War II. As of Wednesday, the fire reportedly is under control and the first residents were allowed back into their houses. Now, 2 years ago, Portugal battled two massive forest fires. Over 60 people died in the flames, and at least 200 more were injured. Portugal said, "Never again," and stepped up fire prevention, slapping on huge fines for those who don't look after the forests. They also found some unlikely helpers, namely goats. Mark Dugger went to find out more, and his report is presented by Holly Young.
A water basin on the edge of the village Nodorinho. 12 people sheltered in the water here for hours before they were rescued by firefighters. Today, a monument serves as a reminder of what happened here. It was personally inaugurated by President Marcelo Rebelo de Sousa a year ago. The fires have since become a collective traumatic memory for the people of Portugal. Just a few hundred metres away is the road where 47 people were trapped in or near their cars by the flames. Nobody survived. Even 2 years later, the hills surrounding the village remain bare, save for the sporadic charred tree trunks left behind. For Luís Fontina, the tragedy still resonates in everyday life.
2017 affected many of us. I worked in the construction industry and lost my job because of the fire. For 24 hours, I couldn't reach my daughters. I didn't know where they were or how they were doing. These feelings still affect me, as well as the fear of the fire. But I only lost objects. Other people lost their lives.
E eu estou a falar de perdi bens materiais, não é grave. Houve pessoas que perderam a vida.
Lurish never wants such a disaster to happen again, and he wants to be part of the solution. So he's enlisting the help of some local animals. Lurish now works as a goat herder. The state currently supports 39 herds, a total of 4,900 goats, including Lurish's. As it turns out, goats are ideal when it comes to fire prevention.
Goats are robust animals. They can also be used at high altitudes. They eat the undergrowth, so they can clean the forest. And you can use them for other things too. You can use their milk to make goat cheese or sell their meat.
An overgrown, poorly maintained forest is essentially tinder just waiting to be ignited by the smallest flame. Lumbered logs or dry twigs act as fire accelerants. Because of the risk, anyone who doesn't clear undergrowth from their land faces severe penalties in Portugal. And the government has increased them since the recent fires. So goats now have a brand new role, effectively serving as vacuum cleaners of the forest.
If you were to clear a piece of woodland in the conventional way, you'd expect to pay around 400 euros per hectare. Goats are much cheaper, only around 25 euros per hectare. That's a huge difference.
Lurish's goats have already cleared around 20 hectares. In the first year, the state pays him 120 euros for every goat that helps clear the forest. But according to forester and environmental activist Domingos Patacho, using goats as a fire prevention tool is nothing new.
The goats have the same role in Portugal today as they once did earlier. They are the kind of animals that actually eat everything. They're not very picky. Roaming shepherds used to travel with the goats through the woods to clear them. But today, hardly anyone wants to do this kind of work. The climate's harsh and the pay is bad.
The forest fires in this region can also be linked to Portugal's rural exodus. Wild overgrowth isn't uncommon in unpopulated areas. Lurish also left for a while, working in England for a few years. But now, with the help of his four-legged firefighters, he wants to make a fresh start in his homeland. He hopes the project will be a success, and anyway, this area could do with some more goats.
Holly Young with that report by Mac Duggar. Extreme heat and drought has also taken a toll on farmers, particularly in the Horn of Africa and Sahel regions, and the dry corridor in Central America. The UN's Food and Agriculture Organization estimates that the dry corridor is experiencing one of the worst droughts in the last 10 years, with over 3.5 million people in need of humanitarian assistance. In Nicaragua, farmers are now learning to adapt to the ever harsher climate conditions by monitoring rainfall. Lisa Josefsson-Hermann went to explore. Her report is presented by Samantha Baker.
In the overwhelming heat, the shade inside this humble countryside house is refreshing. Blanca Landero Batarco shows me her stored red beans, an important part of her diet, along with rice. In Nicaragua, it's just called basic grains. People here have gallo pinto, rice and beans, every day. Blanca was born here in a village called La Gracia to parents that were small subsistence farmers. But climate change, rising temperatures, and serious drought are making life almost impossible for local farmers like Blanca.
Climate change has affected our production a lot. Climate change makes the weather fickle. Today it rains, tomorrow it doesn't. And then the heat is so intense.
Blanca's farmhouse is located in Chinandega, in the northwestern part of Nicaragua. There's a reason this area is called the Dry Corridor. The Central American Dry Corridor is a tropical dry forest region stretching from the southern Pacific coast of Mexico to Panama, with the most vulnerable parts being Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Nicaragua. The region is known for its irregular precipitation, and according to the Global Climate Risk Index from German Watch, Nicaragua is one of the most vulnerable countries in the world when it comes to climate change. It also happens to be the poorest country in Central America. Between 2014 and 2016, a drought devastated the region, decreasing food production in the dry corridor. With the phenomenon of El Niño, the drought was even more defeating. While several Central American countries declared a state of emergency during the long period of drought, Nicaragua didn't.
Nicaragua no lo hizo, se quedó fuera porque...
Nicaragua avoided declaring a national emergency because it would negatively impact the country's climate for international investment. That's why Nicaragua did not receive aid, despite having a serious food crisis in the dry corridor.
Victor Campos is the executive director of the Humboldt Center, one of the leading NGOs in the country working on climate change and environmental issues. According to recent measures from the Humboldt Center from this year, high temperatures up to 40 degrees Celsius were recorded in Chinandega, with a felt temperature of 43 degrees Celsius. This indicates that temperatures are increasing to extreme levels. Two of Blanca's sons work at local factories, and the family survives with the little money they make. But still, Blanca and her family felt the consequences of the drought on their everyday lives.
Aquí se perdió todito. La producción de frijoles.
We lost everything during those years. The harvests of beans, plus rice and corn. I don't know how we managed to survive.
No sé cómo hemos hecho para sobrevivir.
There are no available official statistics from the Nicaraguan state about how the drought affected the population. There is only the information collected by organizations like the Humboldt Center. In 2016, the effects of climate change meant a serious reduction in food production.
Around 90% of the corn production and approximately 60% of the bean production failed. The lack of precipitation has threatened people's food security. We do have statistics about the decrease in food production, but not how that affected the caloric intake per person. But we assume that there has been a strong impact.
In the village of La Gracia, Blanca saw the tough consequences.
Here, some people starved to death. Others got skinny. Those years were very hard around here. A lot of people left. The majority of those who left are now in Costa Rica, Panama, and Spain.
Nicaragua has experienced an intensified humanitarian, political, and socioeconomic crisis in the past year. It's a situation that reinforces problems like climate change that the country is already struggling with. More than 55,000 people have fled to neighboring Costa Rica because of the political crisis, adding to those who have already left because of drought. One of those who left is Blanca's son.
I don't want him to leave because he's very young. He had told me, "You won't be able to give me clothes. I must leave."
Blanca's 25-year-old son, Norlin Alberto Martinez Silvia, sits in a small coffee shop in Cartago, near San Jose, the capital of Costa Rica. He just ended his shift as a watchman at a private school.
I came to Costa Rica last year to look for better economic conditions.
Back in Nicaragua, Norlin worked in a food processing factory. His monthly salary was equivalent to $200. In Costa Rica, he earns the equivalent of $600 a month and sends half of it to his mother in Nicaragua.
It's a big sacrifice to leave your country, your family, and friends. My dream is to save money to build a house. I wouldn't have been able to do that with my salary in Nicaragua.
The drought has also created problems with drinking water for Blanca and others in the dry corridor.
There were great rains. In Chinandega, we had a great river. Today, there's no river. It's more like a puddle.
The Humboldt Center is teaching farmers like Blanca how to measure the rainfall and how to use this information to try to predict the season's rain and make decisions about when to plant seeds, for instance. Here's Victor Campos again.
Since people began to feel the effects of climate change, they have been adapting. Climate change adaptation isn't new. People are adapting to survive. Helping them adapt is essential to help solve the issue of food security. Decisions about adaptation to climate change should be made based on a deep knowledge of the climate. We are trying to help the farmers with information so they can make the decisions in a more informed way.
Since 2016,
Blanca has been measuring precipitation levels each day. She proudly shows the pluviometer, a plastic tube that makes it possible to easily measure the rainfall at her house. She pays close attention to the beginning of the rainy season and measures the soil to determine when it's best to sow her seeds.
I'm worried about the situation because we want to eat and we want to produce.
Monitoring the rainfall gives her a sense of preparedness against the uncertainty. However, with the prognosis for this year's conditions not looking good, she can only hope the harvest will exceed expectations.
Samantha Baker with that report by Lisa Josephson-Hermann. When we return, we'll hear how to recycle energy from wastewater and how that can be used to cool down buildings. It's nice and cool inside our studio today. Upstairs in our office, we don't use aircon to cool down, but a trusted old fan. I'm not gonna lie, that was particularly tough last week when we almost cracked the 40 degrees Celsius mark. But using air conditioning comes with its own set of problems. For one, more demand for aircon means more demand for power. And unless we use 100% renewable energy, it also means more emissions and even hotter temperatures. And then, of course, there's the so-called urban heat island effect, where aircon units funnel heat outside and, well, heat up the city even more. A better way to cool down buildings? Using thermal energy from wastewater. I caught up with Nick Meaton, Director of Applied Energy based in New Zealand, at the Resilient Cities Conference here in Bonn, organized by ICLE, that's short for Local Governments for Sustainability. That's a global network of more than 1,700 local and regional governments committed to sustainable urban development. And Nick was here to share solutions for cities to use wastewater for energy demands. One of his specialties is mapping the heating and cooling that's available in cities. How do you recycle energy from wastewater?
So wastewater is essentially just like normal water. It's 99.9% water. So it may be dirty water, but the ability to provide heating or cooling is the same as normal water. If we think of every city, there might be thousands or tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of houses and apartments and buildings, and each one of those is delivering free heat that they use into the wastewater network. So in the winter time, there's a huge amount of heat that can be used. Equally, apart from the hot water used in these houses and apartments, is also cold water, which goes into the sewer network. So what we end up with is a very slightly warm but neutral flow of water. It goes right through the city in the wastewater pipes. It carries an enormous amount of capacity for heating and cooling. The way that the energy is recycled is very simple. It's just with heat exchangers and heat pumps, these things. This is normal equipment. The heat exchangers themselves need to be special to work with wastewater. All of the other equipment is very normal equipment.
What happens once I've discharged water from my house?
The costs involved with using heat or cooling from wastewater are normally too high for it to be relevant for one household. So we're looking at larger buildings, perhaps office buildings or swimming pool centres. This is a really good one because they use an enormous amount of heat all of the year round. Those are the sort of buildings which are really good candidates for using this free heating. It allows the cities then to stop using gas or coal or wood or some fuel to make heat. We're just capturing the heat which is donated from many, many small buildings and bringing that together in the wastewater pipes and then using it for heating of larger buildings.
How much energy could we save?
Very roughly, I think the wastewater network of most cities, you could probably heat about one building in every five. So let's, you know, one in five, one in six buildings could be heated from the energy that's in the wastewater. But the amount of water that a building makes on its own is not enough to heat that building. That's still quite an enormous amount. 15 to 20% of all of the heating and cooling needs for a whole city, which is available for free from the sewer network, and cities have this available. I think there's somewhere around 1,000 projects already installed around the world and running. There's quite a few already in Germany, there's quite a few in Switzerland, there's a lot in France. Scotland are using this more and more. In New Zealand right now we have two projects which are in construction or in design, and there's probably about another six which are coming in the near future.
How do you get the energy out of the wastewater, out of the sewage system?
It's very simple thermodynamics. So you're taking a flow of dirty water that passes through a special heat exchanger. This is really the main special equipment that's needed. Through that heat exchanger, you can then take heat out of the water or put heat into the water, and from there it becomes very normal equipment. We're talking about refrigeration equipment, chillers or heat pumps, these things. The main difference is where we take the heat from or put the heat to, instead of the atmosphere or instead of burning fuel, fossil fuel, LPG or whatever, we are simply taking heat from or putting heat into the wastewater. Most heat pumps at the moment have a heat exchanger which is on the outside of a building with a fan and uses the air, the atmosphere, as the thermal source. And so in winter, what that heat pump does is takes heat out of the air and uses the heat pump to blow inside the building, either makes warm water or warm air. And in summer, it's just like a refrigerator. In the summer, it's the reverse. You are moving heat from inside the box, in this case it's a building, to outside and blowing it into the atmosphere. It's exactly the same principle. We're just using wastewater instead of the atmosphere. And because it's very stable, you're not fighting nature so much. In winter, when we most need heating, is when the atmosphere is the coldest. And so it's very difficult to pull heat out of the cold atmosphere. It's very easy to pull heat out of the relatively warm wastewater. And in the summer, when we most need cooling, it's very difficult to push heat into the very hot atmosphere like we have right now. It's very easy to push heat into the relatively cool wastewater. And because you're not fighting nature so much, it means the whole system has an easier job, it operates more efficiently, and it uses less energy to do the job.
Is it difficult to convince local governments?
Increasingly not, because I think all governments, when they look at their city, they're thinking, how can we do things more efficiently? And one of the good things about this idea is that the city already has the wastewater network. That infrastructure is already there. They've already paid for it. They've invested with all these pipes in the ground. The city is having donations to them every day from the citizens of their free heat. And so the cities are collecting all of these little bits of heat from tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, houses of apartments, and collecting it all together in their wastewater system. So the city can start to use this infrastructure more than just for transportation of dirty water. They can use it as an energy collection network. They don't have to dig up the roads and streets to put in a new layer of infrastructure. It's already there. There are more and more examples coming about cities who are now starting to sell this energy back. So it can be a win-win situation for the city to get some money, which at the moment they're not getting, and the customer also actually pays less for heat than they would otherwise. And if the electricity that's used to power the heat pumps is coming from a clean energy source, then the carbon reductions come right down as well.
That was Nick Meaton speaking to me at the Resilient Cities Conference in Bonn, Germany. Let's turn to Paris, where a similar system is in place. The French capital uses water from the River Seine, though. The vast network of pipes beneath the streets of Paris provides cooling to office buildings, department stores, and even the famous Louvre. Sabine Wax went to check it out, and her report is presented by Ineke Mules.
It's a bit reminiscent of a James Bond or Indiana Jones movie. In the middle of Paris, directly on top of the beautiful Baroque-style bridge Pont Alexandre III, a concrete lid reveals a spiral staircase descending 40 metres down below the streets into Europe's largest underground cooling system. Technical director Jean-Sébastien Marseille leads the way.
This is a facility which produces ice water. By using the water, which is cooled down here, we can provide air conditioning to an area of around 500,000 square meters.
Climatisés qui peuvent être produits à travers cette centrale.
There are 10 of these cooling plants throughout Paris. Together, they provide cool air for around 5 million square meters. And they have some pretty famous customers, explains Jean-Charles Boulier, the director of Climespace, which built the system.
For example, a museum like the Louvre is a client of Climespace.
The Louvre is one of our customers because maintaining a constant temperature is important for the paintings. We also supply cool air to major hotels such as the Hyatt, and even shopping centers like the Galerie Lafayette.
Après, vous avez les centres commerciaux, Galerie Lafayette, Printemps, Bon Marché.
Office buildings also benefit from the cool air supplied via the 70-kilometer-long pipe system. Jean-Charles Boulier explains how the process works.
De faire du froid comme des frigos.
It works like a refrigerator. Here, we cool the water, which enters the closed system at about 4 degrees. The cold water is then transported to the customer via the pipes to a special device which the customer has installed. This device works by extracting the cold temperatures out of the water and cooling the air in the rooms.
Vous piquez le froid et après c'est distribué chez lui.
The remaining warm water continues to flow through another pipe system back into the refrigeration plant under the Pont Alexandre III. We go into an elevator which takes us 20 meters deeper. Massive blue and green pipes fill the room. The blue pipes transport the cold water underground, and the green pipes bring the warm water back to the plant. This is where the refrigeration system is connected. The pumps rattle loudly as they draw water from the nearby Seine, which also serves as a source of naturally cool water. The warm water is partially cooled by the water from the Seine before it begins the refrigeration cycle once again. Back in the first room, Jean-Sébastien de Marseille shows in a computer screen exactly where the cool air is being retrieved from.
Opéra, Aubert, Léal, Hôtel de Ville.
In the Opera, in the Léal shopping centre, in the Town Hall, and even in the National Library.
Although it processes a huge amount of cool air, the underground factory is still quite environmentally friendly. Because the water is mostly cooled by the river rather than artificially, it uses relatively little power for a plant of this size. And unlike normal air conditioners, the system does not pump out hot air, explains Jean-Charles Boulier.
Usually, when people walk through the streets, warm air comes out of the buildings because of the air conditioning. In cities like Paris, where there are few trees and many buildings, that is where the heat comes from. But it's not like that with our system, so it's good for the environment.
Climespace started back in 1991 with just one customer and 3 kilometers of pipes. Today, they supply more than 600 customers. As the underground pipe network continues to expand, Jean-Charles Boulier hopes that one day the cooling system will also be used in people's homes.
Ineke Mules with that report by Sabine Wax. And that's our show for this week. For more Living Planet, go to dw.com/livingplanet, where you'll find links to our media center and our podcast on iTunes and SoundCloud. And don't forget to check out dw.com/environment. Thanks very much from all of us in the studio, Eliane Gigliarducci, Christoph Grove, and me, Sarah Steffen. Bye for now.